DW Africa Link.
It's Wednesday, the 6th of November, 2019. Welcome to the midweek edition of Africa Link, coming to you live from our studio here in Bonn, Germany. I am Eddie Micah Jr.
And I am Shola Jaisame. Listen to the show on our Facebook page, DW Africa, but also join the discussion there on the stories we're covering.
Coming up on the program, Cameroon President Biya marked his 37th year in power on Wednesday, but some believe that his Secretary General Ferdinand Ngongo is the man currently calling the shots.
Decisions that come out from the presidency now are signed by the Ferdinand Ngongo, meaning he's the one really ruling the country. Means something is really in the pipeline.
Also coming up, some scientists say the origin of modern humans is in northern Botswana, but others disagree.
The study greatly oversimplified it and went way too far with the extrapolation that modern humans originated in northern Botswana. We don't know the exact location, and likely there isn't a single location.
Well, it seems the debate will go on for a while, but hey, stay tuned for all those stories and more right after the news in brief.
DW News.
And my name is Jane Nyinge. 8 people have been wounded, including 4 tourists, in a stabbing attack in Jordan's historic city of Jerash. The injured, 1 Swiss national, 3 Mexican and 4 Jordanians, are currently receiving treatment, with one of the victims in serious conditions. The attacker is currently in police custody for questioning. Campaigns for the December 12th upcoming general election in Britain have officially begun. Prime Minister Boris Johnson called for a snap election in a bid to break the Brexit deadlock that he says has paralysed the country for more than 3 years. Johnson urged voters to back his Conservative Party's bid to withdraw Britain from the European Union.
It's been frankly mind-boggling in the last few weeks to see how Parliament first voted to approve this deal and then voted for delay, and I'm afraid that it is clear that if Parliament had its way, then this country would not be leaving even on January the 31st. And that, of course, is bad for democracy. It's disastrous for trust in politics. Why should MPs decide that they can cancel the result of a referendum?
The Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn kicked off his party's campaign with speeches in a series of constituencies. Brexit is likely to dominate the election campaign, but candidates will also focus on other issues, including healthcare and climate change. Over 500,000 people have been displaced by flooding in Somalia. An aid operation is now underway amid concerns about the spread of deadly diseases such as malaria. President Mohamed Farmajo visited Delawen, one of the towns that has been heavily affected by the floods.
We came here to express our sympathies to those affected by recurrent floods. We know that last year's floods were the worst on record, but this year, the floods may eclipse what we experienced last year. For those affected by the floods, may Allah grant mercy to those who have perished and the dispersed.
This news comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has announced that his country has captured one of the wives of Islamic State leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who died during a raid by U.S. forces in Syria over a week ago. Erdogan said Turkey did not make a fuss about it, as the U.S. did when al-Baghdadi was killed. He stressed that the current counter-terrorism efforts are more effective than ever. And finally, French Prime Minister Edouard Philippe vowed Wednesday to take back control of the country's migration flows by imposing quotas on certain categories of skilled migrants and cutting back benefits available to asylum seekers. President Emmanuel Macron has for months been taking up a tough approach to immigration, urging that France must end its lax approach to prevent voters from drifting to the far right. And that's the news. My name is Jen Nyingi.
This is Africa Link, live from our studios in Bonn, Germany. I am Shola Jaisimi.
And I am Eddie Micah Jr. DW Africa is our Facebook page, so go and leave your comments there on the stories we're covering. Talking about our page, so many comments coming through already. Well, this is from Tutu Desnick, who's always tuned in. Says, 37 in power, nothing to show. Larry says, you tune in from the USA. Vela Hanorin says, hi, DW Africa. Well, hi back right at you.
Now to a major story on the continent about a president still clinging to power. Political rallies have been organized in all the towns and villages of Cameroon to celebrate the 37th anniversary of the long-serving leader, Paul Biya.
Yes, 37 years in power. His current seven-year mandate will end in 2025, when he'll be 92 years old. Now, there are ongoing discussions about his health and ability to rule, but what's topping discussions are that people believe the president has ceded his signature to his Secretary General, Ferdinand Ngongo, who many see as his possible replacement. Moki Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
This song, that Biya is strong enough to continue to lead Cameroon, is chanted in public meetings. His CPDM party called on supporters to come out and celebrate his 37th anniversary in power as a sign of their support and commitment to him. But discussions on the street are on the ability of the 86-year-old to continue to lead Cameroon. 30-year-old Tichangwa Collins has known only one president his whole life.
Our president, who used to be very vibrant, spending most of the time out of the country, out of a sudden started spending more time in the country than outside. Like this year, he had to travel to China and Russia, but he did not go. So he instead traveled to Geneva for his health care, meaning that he is tired and his health cannot permit him to continue. Therefore, he has to try everything possible to leave the scene in an honorable manner.
Speculations have been rife in Cameroon that Biya's Secretary General Ferdinand Ngongo now rules. Biya ceded his signature to the 85-year-old 3 times this year. Yaoundé-based businessman Epie Hans believes in these speculations.
Decisions that come out from the presidency now are signed by the Ferdinand Ngongo, meaning he's the one really ruling the country. Early this year, the president made him a minister of state, secretary general at the president of the republic, when he was formerly only the secretary general of the presidency. So given the fact that he has been added minister of state, secretary general at the presidency, means something is really in the pipeline.
Ngongo, who hails from the Upper Sanaga Division in Cameroon's Central Region, is said to be a relative of Cameroon's First Lady Chantal Biya. He is said to wield power more than any other minister and answers to Biya alone. Professor Ngole Ngole Elvis, one of Biya's collaborators and former minister, reacts to media reports that Biya had allowed Ngongo to do much of his work.
Yes, the Secretary General is one of his closest collaborators, is the Minister of State this time around. There is no leader on earth, especially a Democratic Republican leader, whose leadership style does not involve delegation of powers, delegation of tasks. And I know that President Biya is managerially a conscious leader. He empowers his collaborators.
For now, though, Biya remains the president. He has ruled for over 40 years, 7 as prime minister and 37 years as president. In 2008, he removed term limits from the constitution, allowing him to serve indefinitely. He is now the second oldest president in Africa after his neighbor Teodoro Obiang Nguema of Equatorial Guinea. When his new term is finished, he will be 93 years old.
Moki Kinzeka with that report. And our Facebook page is buzzing with comments.
Exactly. And we have Ole Merfu, who is saying, may the Lord direct the waves of tsunami like those of Gambia and Zimbabwe to Cameroon.
Well, that's definitely not a positive comment, is there? Angie Kenneth says, I wish for him to resign and give the younger generation a chance to lead this great nation to its full potential.
Oluwabosi says that he's wishing he quits.
Yeah, okay. Indeed, Derek Ngong says, I wish him wisdom to navigate the country out of its current shaky position and as well try his possible, his best, I should say, to leave a legacy behind.
Exactly. So, Hedi, those are the stories that we're hearing there and the comments coming from Paul Biya's 37th year as leader of Cameroon. Now, we will go to some of the stories. Now, scientists believe that modern humans originated from Africa some 200,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But the debate continues about exactly where in Africa.
And the debate seems that it will go on. Recently, some scientists claim that northern Botswana was the most precise location where humankind began. But other scientists disagree. They say that there's almost no way to know the exact location where it all began. But then, how did some scientists conclude that humans originated from northern Botswana? That's the first question my colleague Isaac Mugabe asked Professor Lee Berger from the University of Witwatersrand in South Africa.
The study at hand actually used ancient DNA in living Khoisan people to look for a specific gene that they found originated around 200,000 years ago by their calculations in Khoi people that lived in southern Africa. They then extrapolated the existence of that gene and the location of the people that they sampled with a hypothesis that this therefore located where the origins of modern humans lie in a region around the Makarikari Pan.
How significant are the findings of the study now published in the scientific journal Nature?
So I think there's a fundamental problem with this research in that while the basis of the research, the exploration of this gene in these living populations of humans is a valid and interesting scientific discovery, the extrapolation that these authors and scientists to pinpoint a location in northern Botswana is quite frankly impossible. What they're trying to do is take a single line of evidence in a gene existing in people 200,000 years distance from the source of that gene in time. They're arguing that those people, the populations have not moved from that area, that there's been no introgression from other areas, and they're using that to take a very extreme view that this indicates that this is where modern humans arrived. And I think that this study greatly oversimplified it and perhaps went way too far with the extrapolation that modern humans originated in northern Botswana.
To date, how much is known about Africa as the origin of humans?
So what we know from both archaeological, from the paleontological, the fossil record, and from the DNA record, the record of both living humans' DNA, which we can map back in time, and ancient DNA that we extract from fossils themselves, like Neanderthal fossils or Denisovan fossils, is the predominance of modern human origin story comes from Africa. We are, by a vast majority of our origins in both DNA, archaeology, our morphology, our fossil record comes from Africa. We are fundamentally, as a species, even a global species, an African species. That the journey to become what we are today was a complex one, which first happened in Africa, and then with small introgressions, that is, exchanges of DNA with populations outside of Africa, like the Neanderthals, like the Denisovans, and with other populations within Africa, we became what we are today, this vast, widespread global species. We, Homo sapiens, are an African animal. It's just that we don't know the exact location, and likely there isn't a single location.
That was my colleague Isaac Mugabe speaking to Professor Lee Berger from South Africa. And we've been talking about where exactly
did we all originate from? Well, the scientists are saying somewhere in northern Botswana, but I don't know. I'm just remembering the social science studies that we were taught way back in those good old days in primary school.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very difficult, obviously, to say exactly where. That's why they're opposing views. You know, who knows? Maybe from Ghana. That's where it all began, no? I mean, you'll never know these days how things are going. But it's very interesting that this debate is still going on. What is most important, as it's clear most scientists agree on, is that humankind sort of began on the African continent.
Mm-hmm.
And me as an African, I'm proud to hear that, no?
Exactly, same here too.
Okay, so well, we will be back with more comments. More comments have come through our Facebook page, DW Africa. So keep those comments coming through. Of course, we'll be reading them out when we can. This is Africa Link, coming to you live from our studio here in Bonn, Germany. I am Eddie Micah Jr.
And I am Shola Jayesimi. This program streams live on our DW Africa Facebook page, so do join us with your comments on the stories we're airing.
Coming up in the next 15 minutes, Ethiopian Jews optimistic about starting a new life in Israel express sadness at difficulties encountered in getting repatriated.
Some of us have been here in Gondar for more than 25 years. Some of our relatives are in Israel with their families. Now we are the ones left behind in our journey to Israel.
Don't miss out on this story, but first let's head to South Africa, where the euphoria is still high after the country's rugby team, the Springboks, won the third World Cup. But can this newfound unity, 25 years after the fall of apartheid, wish away current problems in the country? DW's Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
South Africa's newly found unity was evident at the OR Tambo International Airport on Tuesday evening. Blacks, whites, Indians and coloureds hugged, danced and sang in unison as the Springboks landed with the trophy in hand. And team captain Siya Kolisi stressed the players' unity as the source of their win.
We go through a lot of challenges as a country, and we always find a way to get through it, especially when we get together and know everybody and we start fighting for something. And we knew if we lost another game, that was it for us. And we had to fight every single game like it was a playoff, so we gave it everything we could.
And Mamelo Maka, a Springbok supporter, shared Kolisi's sentiments.
We are proud of what Bokes did for South Africans, because after this, we'll, maybe South Africa will be more united, you know, we'll love each other, and they showed us love.
But one local publication has described the victory unity as a holiday from problems that plague us. When Springboks first won the Rugby World Cup in 1995, the team had only one black team member, and the country still profusely bled from the impact of apartheid that had ended in the previous year. Fast forward to 2019, the country is facing a mountain of challenges, including an ailing economy, high unemployment, shocking levels of corruption, and xenophobic violence. These and other challenges that existed before the match still exist now. However, David Hogg, a South African, says the team's collaboration provided a clue on how the country's problems can be solved.
For South Africans, for the Rainbow Nation, we're so proud and so excited, as you can see. This is in the spirit of unity and Ubuntu, and we've got a bright year ahead of us.
Many people say it's comforting enough that the team has a black captain and about five black players in the squad that brought the cup home. Sipho Hlela, a researcher at Meltwater, a media intelligence company, says a monitoring of social media discussions shows that the Springboks win got South Africans talking about unity.
Siya Kolisi has really won the hearts of every South African. You know, when the article came out that his father's going to be going up to watch him play for the first time, I think on the day alone, there were over 17,000 mentions speaking about it.
And Sports Minister Natim Tetwa is now asking South Africans from all divide to take advantage of the Springbok win.
They made us to come closer to each other as South Africans. We should not be distracted by anybody. This we should use as a firm base, as we did in 1995, in 2007, and now in 2019, as a firm base to unite our people.
With the Springboks having lined up celebration tours across the country, only time will tell if the unity will last beyond the victory celebrations.
Tuzo Kumalo with that report. So what are people saying on our Facebook page?
Well, Edim, lots of people are talking. There's this one coming from Sanguzego Kapusi. He says, I'm proud of our country, South Africa. When everyone wishes us evil, God stands with us and we rise above. Hallelujah!
Well, amen, I guess, to that. Ugo Emerson says, I'm feeling ashamed for these black South Africans. This game is merely for the whites, and you guys are proud to call them white Africans. This is a obviously a very controversial one, isn't it? I mean, South Africa, obviously, after apartheid, is struggling in terms of identity and all, but it has to be understood and accepted and respected that it's the rainbow nation,
exactly.
Bottom line, and a mix of different people together becoming South Africans.
Exactly. That was the point Tuso was stressing in his report about everybody coming together to celebrate with them at this time. But the issues are still there. The xenophobic attacks, unemployment, mm-hmm. and those key things South Africans have had to deal with.
Exactly. And that's why this debate is going on. But in the meantime, people are celebrating. They've won the World Cup for the third time, beating England in that final. So, well, only time will tell how things will go.
On the spot.
Now, to the story we told you about. Thousands of Ethiopians who consider themselves Jews are still waiting to emigrate to Israel.
They live about 700 kilometers from the capital Addis Ababa in a town called Gondar.
And it seems political and religious reasons are compromising their chances of ever getting to Israel. Michael Oti presents this report by Maria Gert Nicolescu.
A wide cobblestone road leads to Gondar's only synagogue. The town, located in northern Ethiopia, is home to the largest community of Ethiopians practicing Judaism. They call themselves Beta Israel. Every morning, Ashinafi Asi leads the prayers as worshippers dressed in white find a spot on the wooden benches, a Torah opened in their hands.
Some of us have been here in Gondar for more than 25 years. Some of our relatives are in Israel with their families. Now we are the ones left behind in our journey to Israel.
Around 4,000 Jews live in Gondar, close to the synagogue and the Israeli consulate. Many came from the rural areas and chose to settle within the community while waiting to make their way to the Promised Land, as the State of Israel is called. The majority has at least one relative there. Wokinesh Akalu is a mother of six. She and her husband moved from the countryside 10 years ago. The family didn't feel safe anymore and feared attacks from the non-Jewish community.
They burned the crops that we had collected. When this happened, we decided that it's better to leave than to die.
Her husband's family, including his five brothers, is already in Israel, and she says the separation is taking a toll on him. In 2015, the Israeli government pledged to reunite all Ethiopians with their families, provided they have first-degree Jewish relatives in Israel. A list of 8,000 names, established in the 1990s, serves as a basis for the permission. The Israeli ambassador to Ethiopia, Rafael Morav, offered an explanation of the situation.
Many of them actually converted, or their parents converted to Christianity for various reasons, and now they wish to return to be part of the Jewish people, so we embrace them and we accept them.
Reuniting those remaining with their families is seen by the Israeli government as a humanitarian gesture, falling outside the realm of the law of return. But in Gondar, the questioning of the community's Judaism spurs frustration. Some Ethiopian Jews in Israel are said to be opposed to new arrivals from their home country. They claim that some people are in reality missionaries who want to convert Israeli residents to Christianity. Despite the struggle and wait, hope is high among those in Gondar who identify as Beta Israel. This comes at a time Israel's leaders are struggling to form a new government.
That report by Maria Gert Nicolescu, presented by Michael Oti.
Living Planet Africa.
Yeah, the growing demand for infrastructural development of Zambia has come at the expense of the environment.
And that is definitely not good. But a family in the capital, Lusaka, has decided to tackle this through establishing an eco-estate, which will save webs of organisms from extinction. Glory Mushenge has more.
Roger Monge has lived on a farm in Shimabala in the outskirts of Zambia's capital, Lusaka, for over two decades. He and his family have enjoyed a peaceful life surrounded by nature. But thanks to rapid infrastructure development that has caused his neighborhood and his forests, that peace is now being disturbed. construction and street noise have become common in Shimabala. The farm of Roger Monge now remains the only forest here, and realizing that as populations grow, such development is inevitable. According to Monge, they want to accommodate it but still protect that bit of nature and have thus found an answer in the establishment of an eco-estate.
We want to do the eco-estate on all the high ground of the property in such a way that we can conserve all the natural forests that, you know, the family have looked after for all this time, and all the natural wildlife as well. The rate of expansion with SAKA has been absolutely incredible, and it seems to be getting faster and faster. Secondly, the farm borders what was Mpande National Forest, and that is, you can see for yourself, has been completely deforested.
He adds that the estate will have 410 houses spread over 2,000 acres, such that everything will balance ecologically and regenerate the habitat.
The people we're going to work with are the people that are going to buy into the project. They are the people invested in it. And, you know, only people, generally it's going to be people that want to live in nature, want to live in a forest, want to have wildlife around them that will buy into the property. And they will come with rules, which we will set out. You know, you're not allowed to remove trees. You obviously have to look after wildlife. You have to build ecologically. You have to use water according to regulations and recycle water and treat water before it gets put back into the system. All these things. And we hope encourage renewable energy as well.
This elates residents like Wembia Kapapa of Mapepe Farm, not too far from the Monges, who has equally witnessed how the landscape has degraded.
It's good in that at least there will be the environmental impact won't be that much.
Community development activist and conservationist Elliot Goledema hopes wildlife there will not terrorize communities.
Where it becomes a challenge is where these animals or whatever, you know, wildlife that, you know, this particular individual decided to put at his farm, if they start now encroaching in people's, you know, or land or in people's crops, that's where now an issue comes into play. But the motive behind that, I think it is good.
Monge says safety will not be a problem. The farm already has hundreds of different animals and other organisms.
On the economic front, it makes sense.
Yeah.
It'll create a lot of jobs in the community. I think if you can imagine 410 houses, I don't think I'm out of question to say that should create at least 500 direct jobs.
Eco-estates may not be a silver bullet, he admits, but says for ecologically essential areas that are under development pressure, they are a fantastic way of having desirable ecological balance.
Glory Mushenge with that report. But there's been a story also making headlines across the continent, talking about the situation in Liberia, running out of cash.
Ordinary citizens are said not to be able to access their own money at the different ATMs.
Mm-hmm. The economy is the weakest in a long time. Now, comments came on this because we asked the question, can Liberia's President George Weah fix the economy? And some are saying...
Yeah, they're coming torrents. Mohamed Yilia says... He can't fix Liberian economy. He is incompetent and lacks technical know-how how to stabilize his economy.
Alan Kalalu says, until people learn to differentiate democracy and meritocracy, this mediocrity will continue in Africa.
Belwanigre Dennis says, politics is not about celebrities and even academia. Those leaders have unique traits.
Another one from Missy Cronchia says, this is not on the president. It's on the legislatures who are supposed to release the bill for the funds to be available. So this one is saying because the funds have not been released, so that's why the country is facing this trouble.
Well, Dari Akinde Olaide is saying, colonial masters will sponsor wrong persons to the highest and sensitive positions just for Africa to remain backwards.
Dante, though, says, before you guys rush to blame President George Weah, what kind of economy did he inherit from Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, who was former president?
Exactly. Huh? And this one, it's coming from William Minta Waife. ECOWAS must come to his rescue. He can only see Ghana for assistance. Ghana has the men to turn the economy around, But why did you show Weah and Macron picture?
Well, I guess that's, because they've been doing business together, exactly. Like countries too. So, well, anyway, thanks to all of you for bringing the comments. We've enjoyed every bit of it. I am Eddie Micah Jr.
And I am Shola Jayesemi.
Thanks for tuning in.
DW. Made for Mind.